from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, the journalist and trend forecaster James Wallman tells of an ambitious project by a group of researchers to document life in the 21st century. And what they found was just how much crap we all have, or artifacts. We are living in the most materially rich society in global history, with light years more possessions per average family than any preceding society. And Wallman says we've hit a crunch point, a point of material saturation, a peak point in crap. And he says our attitudes are changing. Today in the program, Wallman will join us to explain how a new movement has already kicked in to reverse this trend of materialism. He has a vision for the future where we're shifting away from the value of stuff to the value of experience. Join us after the news.
Friend, follow, and join us on social media to stay connected with the latest goings-on. Find out who's on Radio West tomorrow, what's happening on Capitol Hill, and get a glimpse behind the microphones with pictures and videos of station staff and special events. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter. Search for KUER 90.1.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You've probably been feeling it lately, this impulse to get rid of your stuff, go through your closets, your garage, your attic. It's crazy how much stuff you can accumulate, and it can make you feel sick, make you feel shallow and wasteful. Well, it just so happens that feeling is evidence of a cultural revolution underway, something James Wallman has been writing about. Because Wallman says we've had it up to here with stuff, and our values are starting to shift away from material objects. And he's not overthinking this. We're not going to head for the hills, he says, and live naked in caves. We're still going to need shoes and bags and cell phones. But we are, he says, and you can document this, accumulating less and doing more. We're increasingly less interested in the things you buy, and we're more interested in the things you do, the things you can see and hear and touch and taste. This movement toward experience, that's what you're feeling. And today in the program, James Wallman is joining us to talk about it. James Wallman is a trend forecaster and a journalist who has written for the New York Times, for GQ, and other publications. His book is called Stuffication, Why We've Had Enough of Stuff and Need Experience More Than Ever. And he's joining us today from the studios of the BBC in London. James Wallman, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Doug. How are you?
I'm great. Well, I guess I wanted to begin with a story you tell right at the beginning of the book, a man by the name of Ryan Nicodemus, successful guy, and he figures he's got this equation of happiness figured out. Would you tell this story? Because this is a good way of getting us started, I think.
I'd be really happy to, especially I think it's relevant because he's a really successful American guy. And that's why I wanted to start the book with Ryan, because, you know, when he mentioned to me that he had this golden equation for happiness, he came from a pretty down and out, not totally down and out, but, you know, he lived with his mother. His father and mother had split. They didn't have a lot of money. Sometimes things were kind of rough for him. I think she had some issues with some substances. And he wasn't that happy as a child. And this idea of the equation, it came to him when he was with his father, who was a painter and decorator. And he was with his dad, you know, summer holiday, helping him out, earning some money. And they were taking the pictures down in a house that they were painting and decorating. So they're taking the pictures down so they could put the paint up on the walls. And as he was taking the pictures down, Ryan noticed that all the people in the pictures looked really happy. And I guess it was probably at that point, you know, those teenage years where you're trying to work out what you think about life and how life should be. And he thought, wow, these guys look happy. This house looks nice. I wonder how I could get this. And he turned to his dad and he said, how much would I need to make to have a home like this? And his dad turned to him, and I'm going to try and do a kind of American dad accent here. And if it's really bad, I hope you'll forgive me, because accents aren't my best thing. And he kind of said, son, about $50,000 would do it. How was the accent? Was it
okay? Not bad.
Or was it embarrassing?
Yeah,
it was okay. All right, fine, okay. I have enough American friends with their dads to kind of at least have a go at that anyway. And so he thought, wow, okay, this is it, $50,000. So he actually went to school. He had this best friend, this guy called Joshua. Mm-hmm. And he saw him at school and he said to him, Joshua, look, I think I've worked it out. If we want to be happy, we need to make $50,000 a year. This is the golden equation. Mm-hmm. So after school, they left as soon as possible. They both got jobs. They worked as hard as they could. Within a couple of years, they were earning about $50,000. And they're still best friends, still really good friends. They met up and they had this conversation where they were kind of like, okay, so I'm making about $50,000. You're making about $50,000. How are you feeling? Mm-hmm. And they kind of looked at each other and said, you know, I don't feel satisfied. I don't feel happy. And they couldn't work it out. And then it was Joshua, not Ryan. He suddenly turned to him and said, it's inflation, you know? Inflation has meant that the good stuff costs more, which means that the good life costs more. So we haven't adjusted for inflation. So maybe it's not 50,000, maybe it's 70,000. So, okay, so these guys go away and they carry on working and they were successful. They got to 70,000, they met up and said, okay, how is it? They weren't happy. They kept going till they were bringing home more than six figures, so more than $100,000, doing really, really well. And still, they weren't happy. And I think it was at this point they had this kind of, again, an epiphany, if you like, where they're kind of thinking, okay, so we've adjusted for inflation. We're earning more money. We're at this point, they both had houses that they lived in. They both had big cars. I think one had a Lexus. The other one had a Ford Tacoma truck. They had like these huge flat screen TVs. They had suits from Brooke Brothers. They had, ties. They had shoes. They had loads of stuff. They had everything that the American dream said, this will make you happy. They had a whole bunch of stuff. They had success and they weren't happy.
Yeah.
And they didn't know what to do. And I think they just started looking around. I think it was Joshua that came across this idea of minimalism, this idea that instead of happiness being reached by having more stuff, getting, you know, more success, more stuff. These people that are minimalists chose the other way instead. Their idea was the less stuff you had, the happier you would be. If you think about it, I mean, it's the absolute opposite. And so they thought they'd try it out. And the way they did it was Ryan decided to put all his belongings, and this is serious, right? It's amazing these guys did it. He took all his belongings and put it into boxes and bags like he was going to move house.
Right.
And he tried that out for 21 days. They'd read that was as long as it took to take on a new habit. And the idea was that every time Ryan needed something, he could go get it out of his boxes and his bag. So if he wanted to watch TV, sure, he could take his TV out. If he wanted to have a bowl of cereal, you know, he needs a spoon and a bowl. And obviously, the first morning, he needed a towel and a shower gel and his toothbrush, you know, essential things. But what he found after, I think it was about 10 or 11 days, he wasn't taking anything else out of the bags and the boxes. And he just found that he needed so much less stuff. And he also found without all the complications and the stress that came with managing those things, he felt happier. And he adopted this lifestyle of having less rather than having more. And he's made it his thing. He and Joshua now, they are the minimalists. They have their own brand. They advocate this idea that instead of being materialistic, more is more, capitalist consumers, they are minimalists instead. And that was, the book starts there because I think it's really important to kind of take on the problem. And, you know, the problem for me is materialism. It's the belief that if we have more, we will be more happy. And I think that worked in the 20th century. I don't think it works anymore.
And not only that, you kind of break down some of the studies and some of the research that is being done to show the fact that it's not working anymore and this shift away. There's a political scientist, Ron Engelhardt, that you write about. Would you talk a little bit about his study? Because he's showing that our attitudes are, in fact, over time, he sort of looked at the longer arc of all of this, that we are moving away from this idea of stuff.
Yeah, Ron's a fascinating character. He's a brilliant man, political scientist in the States, and he had a hunch in 1969. Okay, so back in 69, he had a hunch that things weren't just changing in the short term, they were changing in the long term. And, you know, it's a classic, as lots of people was, you know, have an idea. People thought he was wrong. They thought he was slightly nuts. And he produced his first study in 1970. And what he found then was that 80% of people were materialistic. We lived in a materialistic society. And he's been conducting that research, not every year, but on and off, ever since. And it's now become the World Value Survey. And so we have, what is that, about 45 years worth of data?
Yeah.
So we've got about 45 years worth of data, which looks at first world countries and what and other countries as well, actually. But let's focus on the first world countries for now. And what he's found is over the long term, we've become less materialistic because now it's about 50% of people. And for me, as someone that looks at how culture is changing, you know, you can see things change over a year. You know, the economy will affect things. But when you see something happening over 45 years, that kind of long-term change in how people think really makes someone like me believe that things are changing. You know, 45 years is a long time. So in the long term, our society is becoming less materialistic.
I was really interested in the work that you write about from the Center on the Everyday Lives of Families. This is in Los Angeles at UCLA. And basically what they did, and I mentioned this earlier in the introduction, is they figured, all right, let's look at the way we live today. But let's look at it like anthropologists looked at civilizations long past. Would you tell that part of this, because it's interesting? This gives you a sense of just how much crap we have.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. The numbers are really scary. I thought that study conducted by those guys at UCLA was fantastic, really bold. It's the most comprehensive study into how people are living their lives ever conducted, which makes it, I mean, really bold in the first place. And these guys have spent, I think it's about 10 years or so, working out their methodology, doing the research and getting to the results. And a key person involved with that is a woman called Jean Arnold, who's right. been an anthropologist since the early 80s. And they used her, the way that she studied tribes, and for example, in the tribes who lived on the islands just off of California, to look at how people are living today. And their study showed, and they looked at average, middle-class, regular Americans. And what they found, and I think that was some of the phraseology that they used was absolutely fascinating, in their final report, which is this really great document that kind of sums everything up. And they sum it up with words like that we are materially saturated.
Yeah.
And this one I like because it's got a kind of Star Warsy reference. And as a man of my age, I'm a Star Wars fan. They say that we've got light years more possessions than any preceding society in history. And you know, if you think about what your grandparents had, and I think this is true for most people. If you think about the lives that our grandparents lived, or a generation before that, but you go back 100 years or so and you think about the number of pairs of shoes mm-hmm. those people have
yeah.
or the amount of stuff they had in their wardrobe. And then you think about your own wardrobe, you know, your own closet and how many pairs of shoes you have and how much stuff you have in your house.
Hey,
Let me read this because
here's some actual statistics from that section in your book. On average, people had 39 pairs of shoes, 90 DVDs and videos, 139 toys, 212 CDs, 438 books and magazines. That's the average person, the stuff they have. And I don't even know where the clothes fit in and all of that. I mean, that's hard to measure.
There's some statistics later in the book about clothes, actually. And the one that always jumps into my mind is actually a British one. But I think it will probably resonate for Americans as well, is that for British women, the average British woman has about 21 items in her wardrobe that she's never worn. Which is frightening, right? But I think that, you know, you can tell you've never worn it because it's still got the tag on. But it's really important, Doug, that I don't want to be seen as someone who points the finger, because I'm guilty of this. We're all guilty of this. And the thing is, even guilty is the wrong word, because the thing is, the reason why we have so much stuff and the reason why we have abundance is because of the success of our system. Yeah. It's really important to realize that the reason we have all this stuff is because our materialistic consumer system, which really kicked off in the States in the 1920s and really took off, obviously, post-war in the 50s in particular, has engendered a situation where instead of scarcity being the most common issue for most people, mm-hmm. the biggest problem most of us have is abundance.
Right.
So we materialistic consumerism solved the age-old problem that humans have had ever since we came down from the trees, 120, 130-odd thousand years ago. They've solved the problem of scarcity. You know, the biggest problem for most people until the magic of materialistic consumerism was, how do I get enough food to put food on the table to feed my family?
Yeah.
And because of the magic of, the consumer revolution, obviously coupled with the industrial revolution, the green revolution, all of a sudden, in human terms anyway, in terms of our society, we've gone from not having enough food to food being so abundant, we've got the obesity problem. And for me, stuffocation is the exact equivalent of that. It's the material version of the obesity problem. It's a great problem to have. Lucky us that we don't have to worry about having enough stuff. We just have to work out how we're going to manage all this abundance and how we're going to keep our economy ticking over, how we're going to solve some of the problems we've got with the environment, how we're going to solve some of the problems with happiness, the problems of, unhappiness, stress and depression that come with materialistic consumerism. You know, it's about not throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Right.
It's solving this in a positive way.
Well, I think that's the kind of the innovation of your approach. Because one of the things you write about is that when you were looking around at solutions for this materialism, a lot of what you get is kind of anti-capitalist, anti-consumerist, mm-hmm. and in a lot mm-hmm. of ways not terribly realistic. Really, yeah. really kind of overly idealistic. And it seems lovely, but it seems completely impossible, I have to say. And so you saw all of those approaches and you figured in many ways, you talked about it, a lot of those approaches were aggressive, they were too negative, they were not realistic. And so you have kind of decided, as you say in the book, to strike out on your own, try a new approach. Give us a sense as we head to a break of your approach, the way you're looking at this.
Okay, thank you for that, because I really appreciate your understanding of where I've come from. But just to sum it up, really, I think that what we need to do, and I think what we are doing as well, what we need to do is to keep consumerism, because it drives capitalism. Capitalism gives us all this fantastic world that we have. But what we need to do is shift from being materialistic to what I call experientialist. And what I mean by that is, instead of believing and looking for happiness and identity and status and meaning in material things like we did in the 20th century, what we need to do is to find happiness, identity, status and meaning in life in experiences instead.
We're going to dig into that as we get back from a break. James Wallman is with us, journalist, trend forecaster, the author of Stuffocation, Why We've Had Enough of Stuff and Need Experience More Than Ever. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about stuff, about the clothing and the sports gear and all of that stuff you have lying around the house and packed away in the closet. The writer, journalist James Wallman, says, it turns out we are the most materially rich society in global history. And we're also getting sick of that, because Wallman is explaining how we've reached this kind of tipping point and how there's this new movement coming. In some ways, it's already here, a movement to replace materialism with experiences. Would rather experience something than buy it. James Wallman is a trend forecaster, a journalist. His new book is Stuffocation, Why We've Had Enough of Stuff and Need Experience More Than Ever, joining us from the studios of the BBC in London. So one thing I wanted to point out, which I thought this was interesting, you mentioned obesity, the obesity problem. And you've made this connection between materialism and obesity in this sense. And I just wanted you to say something about this. We don't need to spend a lot of time, but how it's kind of baked into our DNA, the evolutionary part of it. How does that work? How is it this idea for us to accumulate stuff? How is that something that we've kind of evolved?
It's a really good question, and this is it's a relatively new field of psychology. It's been around for a couple of decades now. It's called evolutionary psychology, and what evolutionary psychologists seek to do is make sense of who we are and how we make decisions and what we do based on our evolution.
Right.
And it turns out, if you think about it, early modern humans, we've been around for 130,000 odd years. That's a lot of generations. And through those generations, the ones who survived are the ones who ate as much food as they possibly could, because you would never be too far from some kind of scarcity, some kind of famine. You'd never be more than a few generations from a situation where we can get food from.
Yeah.
So therefore, we've had thousands of years of your grandmother, your mother, your father, your grandfather saying to you, eat that food.
Yeah.
That food, you need to eat that now. And the thing is, the people that didn't eat the food didn't survive in the long term. So all of us alive today are the ones whose ancestors were the smart ones, see food, eat food. And you can see this in our families. My father's a really good example compared to my daughter. So my father was born in 1944, just as the Second World War was ending. So he grew up in the 40s and the 50s when food was scarce. In the UK, we had rationing. So therefore, he eats as much food as he can when it comes by him. My daughter, on the other hand, she can be very precious about whether she's having raspberries or strawberries for breakfast, because she, lucky us that we're able to have these foods at these funny times of year. And she can actually say, no, I don't want to eat that, because she knows there's going to be food later. And so we are hardwired as people, as you can't quite say it's human nature, but it's about as close as you're going to get to human nature, that if there is food, you should eat it, and that will make you survive, because when there's no food around, you will carry on surviving. That's why we eat sugar, salt, fat. That's why they appeal to us, because those foods keep us alive. But the problem is, in the 20th century, thanks to the magic of the Industrial Revolution, the Consumer Revolution, we're in a situation for the first time ever in human existence that there has been what they call calorific abundance, plenty of food for everybody. And guess what happens? Because we're so hardwired to see food, eat food, we end up fat. So many people that we have this serious obesity problem. There are suggestions that this generation could live shorter lives than their parents as a whole because of obesity. I mean, that is an incredible thing. And for me, stuffocation is the same, because if you think about it, things used to be scarce and expensive. So there's this brilliant historian I came across called Eve Fisher. She's an Australian woman, and she calculated the cost of a shirt before the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
So we're talking back in kind of 1750 time. And she calculated the cost of a shirt in US dollars, I think, was about $2,500. $2,500 for a shirt, because of the time that it took to grow the sheep, get the wool from the sheep, create the wool into material, and sew that together. And she worked this out at minimum wage. It's worth pointing that out. She worked this out, so that's $2,500 for a shirt. Now, bear in mind, it wasn't so long ago that some of us can remember when furniture was handed down from generation to generation. But before the Industrial Revolution, clothes were handed down from generation to generation as well. They were expensive, they were scarce, and then along comes the Industrial Revolution, the factories, the magic of the factories that can churn out this stuff, and then the Consumer Revolution, where we all start to buy more and more things. This materialism, which drives us to buy more pairs of shoes than we need, more shirts than we need. And to be clear here, we've got a situation where things suddenly become cheap. Mm-hmm. Think how much a pair of jeans costs nowadays. Yeah. Think how much a pair of shoes cost versus what they would have cost for a person 100 years ago. So we've got more money, we're richer. Plus, we've got this situation where it's been hardwired into us. Oh, yeah, if someone offers you a shirt, you take it.
Right.
It's almost like we need to readjust. In terms of, we need to readjust how much we eat, and it's the same in terms of how much we consume in terms of things, material things.
Yeah. It's a shift in values. We've got a sort of rework.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a value system which has been hardwired into us.
Right.
And then, you know, the magic of that consumer revolution was that it was, you know, it was the advertisers and the government leveraged what was inbuilt in our system to make us voracious, profligate, wasteful, conspicuous consumers.
So I'm interested in how you, as a trend forecaster, sort of a cultural observer, how you're approaching this, because I think this is what's so interesting about the book. So let's talk a little bit about that. So you forecast these trends, and we should explain. So this is not exactly predicting the future, but there's something involved there that where you are kind of making these forecasts, and it's based on this idea you write from this essayist, William Gibson. The idea that the future is already here, it's just not very evenly distributed. So explain what that is, how you apply your gifts here to this idea of stuff.
Okay, so it's really interesting you say it's not telling the future. It kind of is and it kind of isn't.
Right.
I don't know if you've come across a guy called Nate Silver.
He
wrote the book called The Signal Noise. He's the political forecaster.
Yeah, 538, in the States.
Exactly, and he gets so much right. I don't know if you follow soccer at all, Doug.
A bit.
Do you follow soccer at
all?
So in the soccer world, being British.
Right.
But he, you know, his method of telling the future is right in so many cases. I mean, he calls the elections right, doesn't he,
absolutely,
in the States. But he famously got the Germany-Brazil soccer World Cup game fabulously wrong. He called it for Brazil. That was what the statistics said. And then Germany beat Brazil something like 7-1.
Yeah,
it was the most
crazy.
Incredible game of soccer I've ever seen. So it just shows that it's not perfect. And I mention that simply that forecasting the future is clearly not an exact science because things happen. But I think that the method I use, and I've been doing this for just over a decade now, helping companies has been my business, helping companies understand how culture is changing so they can adapt what they do to be more relevant. And absolutely, it's inspired, as you say, by William Gibson, by this idea that the future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed. But it's informed, and this is really important, by a guy called Everett Rogers, who was at the University of Iowa. The book, and he published a PhD there in 62. Mm-hmm. And he published this book called The Diffusion of Innovations. Right. And this was a revolution because what Rogers did was he looked at how ideas spread. He looked at what we'd call trends. He looked at how ideas had spread. He looked at anthropological studies. He looked at technological studies. He looked at farming studies. That was his starting point. And he found that ideas spread in a very similar way. And it could be how the use of firearms spread from American... do you say American Indians? Is that the right way to...
These days. Native Americans, American Indians.
Sorry, I never... Yeah, Native Americans. How the use of firearms spread from the East Coast across to the West Coast.
Yeah.
It could be how doctors use certain drugs to make people better. It could be the use of prophylactics. And what he found is there's this wonderful S-curve that describes how ideas spread. And it starts off on the, if you can imagine, I say S-curve, if you can imagine a graph, and on the Y-axis, the vertical axis, is the take-up of something. And on the X-axis, the flat one, that's time. And if you do cumulative, how many people, you know, do this more, it starts off at the beginning with a group of people that he called innovators. They're the kind of crazies, you know. They're the ones who go to Myanmar first on holiday, or maybe, you know, go to Uganda to go see, you know, to go on safari there. Or the people that go to the French-Cambodian, Ethiopian restaurant first. You know, the people that try things out, the innovators.
Yeah.
Next, you get these group of people called the early adopters. And when I use that phrase, people suddenly say, I know what you're talking about now. So you get the innovators and the next group, and they're a bigger group of the early adopters. Then you get the early majority, late majority, and laggards. And the laggards are those people that only turn on their cell phone to make an outgoing call. You know those people? There's still a few of those around, right? My stepfather is one,
right,
for example. And it just describes how ideas spread through any system. So my job and what I've been doing for the past 10 years is to understand and look for the future here in the present,
right,
and to see what the majority are going to be doing tomorrow by looking at what the innovators and early adopters are doing today. So that's where I ply my trade. Yeah. I look for what the innovators and early adopters are doing. So we're looking at, you know, small percentages. But if you understand the circumstances that we live in, you know, the political, the economic, the socio situation that we live in, the environmental factors, technology is incredibly important. If you get a sense of what's going on generally, the water we're swimming in, I think of it, and you can see what the innovators and the early adopters are doing, you can see what they're doing here in the present, what the majority will be doing sometime in the future. So that's the method that I've used to confidently, and I say confidently because I've published a book about it, and I kind of stuck my head above
the parapet. Yeah, it's in writing,
yeah. You know, yeah, exactly. I'm stuck with this now. You know, if I'm wrong, I'm going to look like a fool. But I go with it because there are enough things that are happening. Let's take Ron Englehart's information that shows there is this important trend away from people to be excited about material things and think that that's the best place to find status and happiness and meaning. And there is this nascent, interesting movement towards experiences instead.
Yeah. As we head toward the end of the program, I want to get back to your forecast. Your forecasts are terrific about, you know, what our houses are going to look like, what our work life is going to be like, how our communities are going to change, all based on this idea that we've sort of had it up to here with materialism. So let's talk about what you mean, because you say the shift is away from material things and toward experience. So explain what you mean by experience, because it seems like, and this is one of the things that I think may disappoint some people, you know, this movement away from stuff and toward experience, you say, is not in fact anti-consumer. And it's not necessarily about spending less money. I think that's important to point out.
Yeah, you know, I get picked up on that because there are a lot of people that don't have an issue with our system. I mean, there are some problems with capitalism, right? Capitalism, as we have it today, there are major issues in terms of, you know, we work longer hours than ever before to earn money, to buy stuff we don't need, to impress people we don't like. And it's silly. And it's making us unhappy. And it's causing problems with the environment. And it's not good for people.
Yeah.
And so people say, hold on, okay, so the solution here is to stop consumerism. That's really smart. There's problems with consumerism. We get caught up in this idea of more, 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 keeping up with the Joneses, having more than your neighbour. Let's stop being consumers. Let's have less, or let's be in some way kind of, I don't know, some kind of hippie, happy with who we are and what we are. And I think that's great. And I aspire to be slightly less consumerist myself. But if everybody was to stop consuming and stop spending money, hold on, what happens to our jobs? What happens to our economy? And if something isn't so great for the economy, isn't so great for what's happening with our world, do we have spare money to spend on healthcare? And actually, I don't know about you, Doug, but I like the healthcare we have. You know, we are lucky. We live in this era where people live longer and longer and longer. And that's because we've got spare money to spend on these amazing drugs and kit that keeps us all alive for longer, which gives us more opportunity to have a longer and therefore more fun life, you know, more chance to see our grandchildren and play with our nieces and our friends and whatever. You know, it's a good world we live in. So my take on it is that experience is a slightly nebulous phrase. You know, it's a little bit like freedom, if you like. So I do mean by experiences having a barbecue with your friends at the weekend. I mean, you live in Utah, right? So you've got some of the world's best skiing, haven't you?
Absolutely.
I'm very jealous of that skiing, by the way.
And amazing hiking and all. Yeah, you don't have to go to Bali, right, to have an experience, I guess, right?
Oh, yeah. You live in Utah. Wow, you've got champagne powder over there. So you can go for a walk with a friend. You can have a coffee with a friend. For me, that's – you can do yoga. You can – but equally, you could go to Bali. You could you could go surfing. You could spend money on going to the cinema or you can do all sorts of things. You can take up a class to learn something. The important thing is that instead of having a material good, something that sits at home and you look at and you think, hey, that's bigger than John's next door, or, you know, I've got a fancier pair of shoes than Jane down the road. It's doing something. And there's so much I kind of tried to document the number of ways that experiences are better than material goods. Yeah, and yeah. This is something that the psychologists are working on at the moment.
Let's talk about one of them, for example, hedonic adaptation.
Yeah, hedonic adaptation. And that's simply, we get used to stuff. You know when you get your cell phone, you look at the thing, you push the buttons, maybe you set the ringtone, you put some apps on it, you tell people about the phone. And then what happens 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, a month later? Yeah. You don't notice. It just becomes the thing that you use to talk to your wife or your friends. It becomes just something that you have. And that's hedonic adaptation. We get used to stuff quite quickly. Right. You know, you get it. This is a classic that people think, oh, if I get a new handbag, hey, people are going to look at me differently. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be a different person. I'm going to be something special in some way. And soon you get that thing. It doesn't make a difference. You get used to it really quickly. But with experiences, it doesn't work that way. You know, if you go see your favorite football team, maybe it's the college football team or a basketball team, or you go skiing or you go hiking, you don't get bored of those experiences in the same way. And there's something else that's slightly magical about them, is they kind of build.
Right.
You know, if you go with your buddy to go see a football or a basketball game, and even if your team loses, you still have that experience with that buddy of yours. And it means that the next time you go, it's richer because of that previous time that you went. It kind of builds in a way that, whereas with buying a pair of shoes, you get another pair and the old ones aren't so great anymore. If I was to say the one thing that really made the difference, and this is based on things that people like Dan Gilbert and Daniel Kahneman, you know, some of the America's greatest psychologists, you know, talk about, is that if you're looking for the one thing that's going to make you happy in life, it's about connection. It's about time with friends and family. Mm-hmm. And there's a guy called Tom Gilovich at Cornell University who conducted the first study that showed that experiences were better than material things at making us happy. And one of the points he showed is that even if you do something on your own, you still feel part of the club, the group that does that. So even if you go hiking on your own, or you go just for a walk on your own, or you go have a coffee on your own, you're still kind of one of those people that does that kind of thing. And it doesn't work the same with material goods. You know, if you have a Porsche, you're not so likely to talk to someone else who's got a Porsche. But if you go camping, you've got something in common with someone who camps, you're more likely to talk to that person.
You know, my favorite of those reasons that you mentioned was the fourth reason about identity, that the things that you've done say much more about your identity than the things that you have. I really liked that.
Yeah, I really like that. And it's one of those things that I think it's Tom Gilovich has worked on a number of the studies that look at that. And if you look at, have you seen that movie, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that for me is such a great example of the importance of experiences, because experiences are memories. And it's our memories, even the difficult ones, you know, that time that you got let go by somebody, or the time that you lost your job. I think of the time that I was made redundant about 15 years ago, and it makes me smile now. You know, those things when I missed a flight in the summer, it was terrible at the time. But those things that happen give you a sense of who you are. That sofa doesn't, that pair of shoes doesn't, that handbag doesn't.
Let's take a break, and I want to get back to some of the forecasts you have now, how we are changing, based on this move away from materialism. James Wallman, he is with us. His book is called Stuffocation, Why We've Had Enough of Stuff and Need Experience More Than Ever. We'll take a break and be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with James Wallman. We're talking about his book, Stuffocation. He's joining us from the studios of the BBC in London. So you write in the book that if we're going to evolve as a culture, we have to build this new value system. And you have this kind of manifesto for a new way of being that you lay out in the book. And I want to talk a little bit about this. And what's interesting is, again, it's not about minimalism. It's not just about simple living. You know, it's not negative. It's not regressive. You're trying to give it a more positive kind of outlook. And you talk about how companies are going to have to create new companies that streamline our lives. Governments are going to have to sort of shift their focus away from GDP and trying to sort of measure other things like experiential progress. But how do you measure this kind of thing? I mean, that's interesting. I mean, how do you find a way of measuring well-being and progress? I mean, it's easy to measure how many shoes you have. How do you measure the other thing?
That's such a good question. I've had this. I don't know if you come across a guy called Richard Thaler, wrote a book called Nudge, and he's an economist at the University of Chicago Booth. And one of the things that he said to me when I was discussing this idea with him was he said that this was an argument that he's had been having with Danny Kahneman for the past 20, 30 years. And he says, you can count widgets, but you can't count utils, as in utilitarianism, as in, you know, happiness.
Yeah.
And it's a really fascinating point. I don't buy it, to be quite honest with you. I think that we can measure this. I think we are starting to measure this. You know, the thing is, we have to measure this because I think the 20th century, the great revolution of the 20th century was, well, one of them was the creation of GDP and the national income accounts and the ability to measure the success of a material society. And that was, you know, GDP was created in 1934 by a guy called Simon Kuznets in the United States as a response to the problems of the Great Depression. You know, what the government needs to know, okay, look, there's a problem. How do we measure it? How do we work out where the problems are and we can do something about it? So faced with a problem, structural problem of lack of or overproduction or underconsumption. This is really where the materialistic consumer movement got started. They created the national income accounts. That's where we have GDP from. Mm-hmm. And I think that the process we're going through at the moment is to move beyond GDP and towards a better, more meaningful measure of what matters in society. And this is something that I think it was Bobby Kennedy talked about it back in 69. You know, the problem with GDP is it not only counts the number of pairs of shoes we make, but it counts the number of ambulances we create. It counts the amount of advertising and the amount of money spent on cigarettes, for example. Now, these things are not good for our progress, but they count as GDP. So what we need to do is find another measure and find a way to measure what matters. Yeah. And this was signed into law by Obama in, let me just think, either 2011 or 2013. Excuse me for not quite remembering. But Obama has signed into law this idea that there's this organization called the State of the USA, S-U-S-A, SUSA, which has been created to work out how the United States federal government should measure progress. Now, I'll be honest with you, it looks really complex to me at the moment, but there are questions to be asked about, you know, well-being. The UK government started doing this in 2011. The French were the first, actually, in 2010 to start asking people, how is life for you? Mm. You know, do you feel happy every day? Do you feel satisfied with your life? How stressed are you? And once you start asking people quite subjective questions like that, once you've got a lot of people answering that, then you have quant data.
Yeah.
Once you've got quant data, you've got a yardstick. Are we getting happier? Does this make a difference? And the reason this is important is because I think that the revolution of the 20th century was standards of living. It was quantity of stuff. It was hauling us out of scarcity, giving us abundance. And I think the revolution of the 21st century is to move from stuff and standards of living to quality of life. I think that's what, now we've got standards of living. Mm. Let's get quality of life. And so it's being investigated and it's being improved. And I just want to make a small point here because lots of people say, well, James, you know, I'm happy you believe this is a great idea, but this is, you know, those ways of measuring, you know, the post-GDP ways of measuring things, which they're doing in Maryland. There's this thing called the gross progress indicator, which is being used by some states in the States. Is that the national income accounts, of which GDP is a part, was first published in 1934, and it wasn't adopted by the global community until the late 50s. So it took about a quarter of a century, took about 25 years to be adopted by everybody, by which point we can say, okay, you know, America's got the biggest GDP, who's number two, who's number three? Because we all know nowadays, don't we? It's, you know, China, America, you know, who's got the biggest GDP? This has become the yardstick by which we measure progress. But it took 25 years for this to be the thing that everybody did. And so do I think that within the next 25 years, we're going to get better at measuring what matters and we're going to reach a point where we've got a really serious contender that is better than GDP? Yes, I do. That's where I think we're headed. And I think that's the exciting thing for the 21st century. Lucky us, from standards of living to quality of life.
I want to shoot through as quickly as we can, because we're running out of time, some of the forecasts you make for how you see this playing out in the future.
Yeah.
You foresee that we're going to be buying more experiential products, that we're going to prefer goods that are less wasteful, less harmful for the environment, and even that people are going to start buying goods that occupy no physical space at all. That is, signing up for services that give access, so more of a sharing economy. Talk a little bit about your vision of how you see the economy transforming in this new age.
I'm going to give you two examples because I'm conscious of time and I think this might sum it up. And you've mentioned already the sharing economy. Yeah. And if you think about Zipcar.
Yeah.
Zipcar is this fantastic example of people, they don't necessarily want a car anymore. Particularly this, of course, is in younger people. Far fewer Americans by percentage are taking out a driver's license, obviously particularly in cities. And the thing about Zipcar is people don't necessarily want a car and all the hassle that comes with that, you know, the costs. What they want to do is they want to get from A to B in the quickest and simplest way possible. So what you're seeing is people using Zipcar instead. And there was a study that was run out of San Francisco that found that for every Zipcar that's on the road, it takes 13 other cars off the road. And that's a fantastic example of where people want the solution, not the stuff. And the thing that I wanted to mention about this vision, and I'm going to come back to 1926 here, because in 1926, at a time when America was overproducing, producing more stuff than people were consuming, Henry Ford started to give his workers another day of the week off. Yeah. Henry Ford effectively created the modern weekend, okay? Because before that, people weren't using their cars, if you think about it. You need people, you know, on a Sunday, they would go to church, right? But they didn't have those other days of a week off. But Henry Ford needed people to use the cars that he wanted to sell. So he needed to give them the leisure time to actually use that car. Now, this is a question really, Doug. Do we really think that 5 days on and 2 days off is the peak of human achievement? Is that really what we think? Because if you'd said to someone in 1925, would you have said to them, hey, 6 days on, 1 day off, you happy with that? Hey, I mean, that's crazy, right? Who says we can't have 4 days on and 3 days off? Who says we can't even have 3 days on and 4 days off as the regular thing? Yeah. Now, that's what I mean about a revolution in terms of quality of life. And of course, economists kind of, I've had this conversation, they will attack me for this, but this means that people have got more time to spend on leisure activity. And if you think about the rise of the algorithms and the robots and the computers doing all these jobs, these kind of rote, boring jobs, that maybe we can move on and we can spend our time spending money and having this kind of age of leisure that John Maynard Keynes predicted, and having 4 days on, 3 days off. I think that is possible this century.
We're going to have smaller homes too, you say. Being like a coffee table that turns into a dining room. I mean, we're going to be, and this will take a while to get there. You do make that point, but we'll have smaller homes. We'll have more free time. Our communities will be more, there will be more like, you know, food forests and CSAs and bike sharing, things like that. And I guess our work habits will change in some ways too.
Yeah, it's kind of like Back to the Future,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's kind of, we're going back to that really, that good time, that, you know, this kind of rose-tinted view we have of the past, where people had real communities. And I think we'll have the time to do that. I think we'll choose our jobs less based on the need to earn lots of money, to have big homes, to fill with stuff that we don't need and don't have time to use. And instead, we will do jobs we enjoy. There's a great guy called Ryan Carson, American guy who has this business, and he works 32 hours a week, and so does everybody in his business. They all work 32 hours a week, and he has, I think he's got like 100-odd employees, and he's doing really well. it just sounds great, doesn't it? 32 hours a week sounds really civilized and healthy. And I think that's what we should aim towards, and that's what people are aimed towards. And this idea of the smaller homes, if you think about, you know, the idea of the McMansion, do people want to have big homes that are just bigger to put more stuff in? Or is what you're looking in life for to have, you know, really wonderfully exciting experiential lives? And if you look, again, this is in terms of using my skills as a trend forecaster, if you look at the move, you'll see these tiny homes. There's TV shows about it now.
Yeah.
It's in publications. Yeah. The New York Times has covered it. You've got this fantastic guy called Graham Hill who's done a TED talk on this as well. And it's this ability to have a tiny home and live a fantastic life. Yeah. And technology is making it more possible for us too.
Less than a minute left.
Okay.
We've got to come back to your grandfather. Would you mention the day he died, the note he passed to you? Because I think it really tells the story there.
Yeah. You're going to leave me in tears when I leave this studio, aren't you? This is okay. On the day my grandfather died, he gave me a note, and he wasn't in the habit of giving me notes. But he'd been to my flat. I had a flat in South London. I think I was showing off a little. I had a job in advertising at the time. I was kind of showing off about, you know, my big flat and what I was going to do and what I was going to put here and there. And in the note, he wrote, and I guess, yeah, he died later that day, but and I read the note after he'd left, and it said, "Memories live longer than dreams." And I've read the note. I have it in a little sort of clip frame on the wall in my house, actually, and it, you know, reminds me to think about what matters in life, because I've thought about what he meant. You know, did he mean that the past memories is more important than the future dreams? And I guess maybe at his stage of life, he was 87. But I've come to think that what he meant was he was addressing that question that is the most important question we can ask, the question that Aristotle asked 2,500 years ago, the question that our kids should ask, that we should ask on behalf of our kids. And that's, how should we live in order to be happy?
Yeah.
And I think that what he meant by memories live longer than dreams was that memories which come from experiences matter so much more than materialistic dreams. And I've come to adopt this as my, you know, the phrase that I use that goes with the book and the movement that I want to really kickstart, this experience revolution. That's that memories live longer than things.
James Wallman. His book is Stuffocation, Why We've Had Enough of Stuff and Need Experience More Than Ever. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. James, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks for having me on.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.